This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Nosferatu by Joe Hill, performed by Kate Mulgrew. To my mom, here's a mean machine for the story queen. Die Toten reiten schnell, for the dead travel fast. Lenore, Gottfried Berger. Prologue. Season's greetings, December 2008. FCI Englewood, Colorado. Nurse Thornton dropped into the long-term care ward a little before 8 with a hot bag of blood for Charlie Manx. She was coasting on autopilot, her thoughts not on her work. She had finally made up her mind to buy her son, Josiah, the Nintendo DS he wanted, and was calculating whether she could get to Toys R Us after her shift, before they closed. She had been resisting the impulse for a few weeks, on philosophical grounds. She didn't really care if all his friends had one. She just didn't like the idea of those handheld video game systems that the kids carried with them everywhere. Ellen Thornton resented the way little boys disappeared into the glowing screen, ditching the real world for some province of the imagination where fun replaced thought and inventing creative new kills was an art form. She had fantasized having a child who would love books and play Scrabble and want to go on snowshoeing expeditions with her. What a laugh. Ellen had held out as long as she could, and then, yesterday afternoon, she had come across Josiah sitting on his bed pretending an old wallet was a Nintendo DS. He had cut out a picture of Donkey Kong and slipped it into the clear plastic sleeve for displaying photographs. He pressed imaginary buttons and made explosion sounds, and her heart had hurt a little, watching him make believe he already had something he was certain he would get on the big day. Ellen could have her theories about what was healthy for boys and what wasn't. That didn't mean Santa had to share them. Because she was preoccupied, she didn't notice what was different about Charlie Manx until she was easing around his cot to reach the IV rack. He happened to sigh heavily just then, as if bored, and she looked down and saw him staring up at her. And she was so startled to see him with his eyes open that she bobbled the sack of blood and almost dumped it on her feet. He was hideous old, not to mention hideous. His great bald skull was a globe mapping an alien moon, continents marked by liver spots and bruise-colored sarcomas. Of all the men in the long-term care ward, a.k.a. the vegetable patch, there was something particularly awful about Charlie Manx, with his eyes open at this time of year. Manx liked children. He'd made dozens of them disappear back in the 90s. He had a house below the Flatirons where he did what he liked with them, and killed them, and hung Christmas ornaments in their memory. The papers called the place the Sleigh House. Ho, ho, ho. For the most part, Ellen could shut off the mother side of her brain while she was at work, could keep her mind away from thoughts of what Charlie Manx had probably done with the little girls and boys who had crossed his path. Little girls and boys no older than her Josiah. Ellen didn't muse on what any of her charges had done, if she could help it. The patient on the other side of the room had tied up his girlfriend and her two children, set fire to their house, and left them to burn. He was arrested in a bar down the street, drinking Bushmills and watching the White Sox play the Rangers. Ellen didn't see how dwelling on it was ever going to do her any favors, and so she had taught herself to think of her patients as extensions of the machines and drip bags they were hooked up to, meat peripherals. In all the time she'd been working at FCI Englewood, in the Supermax prison infirmary, she had never seen Charlie Manx with his eyes open. She'd been on staff for 3 years, and he had been comatose all that time. He was the frailest of her patients, a fragile coat of skin with bones inside. His heart monitor blipped like a metronome set to the slowest possible speed. The doc said he had as much brain activity as a can of creamed corn. No one had ever determined his age, but he looked older than Keith Richards. He even looked a little like Keith Richards. A bald Keith, with a mouthful of sharp little brown teeth. There were three other coma patients in the ward, what the staff called gorks. When you were around them long enough, you learned that all the gorks had their quirks. Don Henry, the man who burned his girl and her kids to death, went for walks sometimes. He didn't get up, of course, but his feet pedaled weakly under the sheets. There was a guy named Leonard Potts who'd been in a coma for 5 years and was never going to wake up. Another prisoner had jammed a screwdriver through his skull and into his brain. But sometimes he cleared his throat and would shout, "I know!" as if he were a small child who wanted to answer the teacher's question. Maybe opening his eyes was Manx's quirk, and she just never caught him doing it before. "Hello, Mr. Manx," Ellen said automatically. "How are you feeling today?" She smiled a meaningless smile and hesitated, still holding the sack of body temperature blood. She didn't expect a reply, but thought it would be considerate to give him a moment to collect his non-existent thoughts. When he didn't say anything, she reached forward with one hand to slide his eyelids closed. He caught her wrist. She screamed, couldn't help it, and dropped the bag of blood. It hit the floor and exploded in a crimson gush, the hot spray drenching her feet. "Ah!" she cried. "Ah! Ah! Oh, God!" It smelled like fresh-poured iron. "Your boy Josiah," Charlie Manx said to her, his voice grating and harsh. "There's a place for him in Christmasland, with the other children. I could give him a new life. I could give him a nice new smile. I could give him nice new teeth."
Hearing him say her son's name was worse than having Manx's hand on her wrist or blood on her feet. Clean blood, she told herself. Clean. Hearing this man, convicted murderer and child molester, speak of her son made her dizzy, genuinely dizzy, as if she were in a glass elevator rushing quickly into the sky, the world dropping away beneath her.
"Let go," she whispered. "There's a place for Josiah John Thornton in Christmasland, and there's a place for you in the House of Sleep," Charlie Manx said. "The gas mask man would know just what to do with you. Give you the gingerbread smoke and teach you to love him. Can't bring you with us to Christmasland, or I could, but the gas mask man is better. The gas mask man is a mercy."
"Help!"
Ellen screamed, except it didn't come out as a scream. It came out as a whisper.
"Help me!"
She couldn't find her voice.
"I've seen Josiah in the graveyard of what might be. Josiah should come for a ride in the wraith. He'd be happy forever in Christmasland. The world can't ruin him there, because it isn't in the world. It's in my head. They're all safe in my head. I've been dreaming about it, you know. Christmasland. I've been dreaming about it. But I walk and walk, and I can't get to the end of the tunnel. I hear the children singing, but I can't get to them. I hear them shouting for me, but the tunnel doesn't end. I need the wraith, need my ride."
His tongue slipped out of his mouth, brown and glistening and obscene, and wet his dry lips, and he let her go.
"Help," she whispered. "Help, help, help."
She had to say it another time or two before she could say it loud enough for anyone to hear her. Then she was batting through the doors into the hall, running in her soft, flat shoes, screaming for all she was worth, leaving bright red footprints behind her. 10 minutes later, a pair of officers in riot gear had strapped Manx down to his cot, just in case he opened his eyes and tried to get up. But the doctor who eventually arrived to examine him said to unlash him. "This guy has been in bed since 2001. He has to be turned 4 times a day to keep from getting sores. Even if he wasn't a gork, he's too weak to go anywhere. After 7 years of muscle atrophy, I doubt he could sit up on his own." Ellen was listening from over next to the doors. If Manx opened his eyes again, she planned to be the first one out of the room. But when the doctor said that, she walked across the floor on stiff legs and pulled her sleeve back from her right wrist to show the bruises where Manx had grabbed her. "Does that look like something done by a guy too weak to sit up? I thought he was going to yank my arm out of the socket." Her feet stung almost as badly as her bruised wrist. She had stripped off her blood-soaked pantyhose and gone at her feet with scalding water and antibiotic soap until they were raw. She was in her gym sneakers now. The other shoes were in the garbage. Even if they could be saved, she didn't think she'd ever be able to put them on again. The doctor, a young Indian named Patel, gave her an abashed, apologetic look and bent to shine a flashlight in Manx's eyes. His pupils did not dilate. Patel moved the flashlight back and forth, but Manx's eyes remained fixed on a point just beyond Patel's left ear. The doctor clapped his hands an inch from Manx's nose. Manx did not blink. Patel gently closed Manx's eyes and examined the reading from the EKG they were running. "There's nothing here that's any different from any of the last dozen EKG readings," Patel said. "Patient scores a 9 on the Glasgow scale, shows slow alpha wave activity consistent with alpha coma. I think he was just talking in his sleep, nurse. It even happens to gorks like this guy." "His eyes were open," she said. "He looked right at me. He knew my name. He knew my son's name." Patel said, "Ever had a conversation around him with one of the other nurses? No telling what the guy might have unconsciously picked up. You tell another nurse, 'Oh, hey, my son just won the spelling bee.' Manx hears it and regurgitates it mid-dream." She nodded, but a part of her was thinking, he knew Josiah's middle name, something she was sure she had never mentioned to anyone here in the hospital. "There's a place for Josiah John Thornton in Christmasland," Charlie Manx had said to her, "and there's a place for you in the House of Sleep." "I never got his blood in," she said. "He's been anemic for a couple weeks. Picked up a urinary tract infection from his catheter. I'll go get a fresh pack." "Never mind that. I'll get the old vampire his blood. Look, you've had a nasty little scare. Put it behind you. Go home. You only have, what, an hour left on your shift? Take it. Take tomorrow, too. Got some last-minute shopping to finish? Go do it. Stop thinking about this and relax. It's Christmas, Nurse Thornton," the doctor said, and winked at her. "Don't you know it's the most wonderful time of the year?" Shorter Way, 1986 to 1989. Haverhill, Massachusetts. The brat was 8 years old the first time she rode over the covered bridge that crossed the distance between lost and found. It happened like this. They were only just back from the lake, and the brat was in her bedroom, putting up a poster of David Hasselhoff. Black leather jacket, grinning in that way that made dimples in his cheeks, standing with his arms crossed in front of Kit, when she heard a sobbing cry of shock in her parents' bedroom. The brat had 1 foot up on the headboard of her bed and was holding the poster to the wall with her chest while she pinned down the corners with brown tape. She froze, tilted her head to listen, not with any alarm, just wondering what her mother was worked up about now. It sounded like she had lost something. "Had it! I know I had it!" she cried. "You think you took it off down by the water, before you went in the lake?" asked Chris McQueen. "Yesterday afternoon?" "I told you already I didn't go swimming." "But maybe you took it off when you put on suntan lotion." They continued to go back and forth along these lines, but the brat decided for the time being that she could tune them out. At the age of 8, the brat, Victoria to her second grade teacher, Vicky to her mother, but the brat to her father, and in her heart, was well beyond being alarmed by her mother's outbursts. Linda McQueen's gales of laughter and overwrought cries of disappointment were the soundtrack of the brat's everyday life, and were only occasionally worth noticing. She smoothed the poster flat, finished taping it, and stepped back to admire it. David Hasselhoff, so cool. She was frowning, trying to decide if it was crooked, when she heard a door slam and another anguished cry, her mother again, and then her father's voice. "Didn't I know we were headed here?" he said. "Right on cue." "I asked if you checked the bathroom, and you said you did. You said you had everything. Did you check the bathroom or not?"
"I don't know."
"No, probably not. But it doesn't matter, 'cause you didn't leave it in the bathroom, Linda." "Do you know why I know you didn't leave your bracelet in the bathroom?" "Because you left it on the beach yesterday. You and Regina Rosen had yourselves a bunch of sun and a bucket full of margaritas, and you got so relaxed you kind of forgot you had a daughter and dozed off. And then when you woke up and realized you were going to be an hour late to pick her up from day camp, I was not an hour late. You left in a panic. You forgot the suntan lotion, and you forgot your towel, and you forgot your bracelet, too. And I wasn't drunk either, if that's what you're implying. I don't drive our daughter drunk, Chris. That's your specialty. And now you're pulling your usual shit and making it someone else's fault. The brat was hardly aware she was moving, wandering into the dim front hall and toward her parents' bedroom. The door was open about half a foot, revealing a slice of her parents' bed and the suitcase lying on top of it. Clothes had been pulled out and scattered across the floor. The brat knew that her mother had, in a spasm of strong feeling, started yanking things out and throwing them, looking for the lost bracelet. A golden hoop with a butterfly mounted upon it, made from glittering blue sapphires and ice-chipped diamonds. Her mother paced back and forth, so every few seconds she flicked into view, passing through the sliver that the brat could see of the bedroom. "This has nothing to do with yesterday. I told you I didn't lose it at the beach. I didn't. It was next to the sink this morning, right beside my earrings. If they don't have it at the front desk, then one of the maids took it. That's what they do, the way they supplement their incomes. They help themselves to whatever the summer people leave around." The brat's father was silent for a while, and then he said, "Jesus, what an ugly fucking person you are inside. And I had a kid with you." The brat flinched. A prickling heat rose to the backs of her eyes, but she did not cry. Her teeth automatically went to her lip, sinking deep into it, producing a sharp twinge of pain that kept the tears at bay. Her mother showed no such restraint and began to weep. She wandered into sight again, one hand pressed over her face, her shoulders hitching. The brat didn't want to be seen and retreated down the hallway. She continued past her room, along the corridor, and out the front door. The thought of remaining indoors was suddenly intolerable. The air in the house was stale. The air conditioner had been off for a week. All the plants were dead and smelled it. She didn't know where she was going until she got there, although from the moment she heard her father dish out his worst, "What an ugly fucking person you are inside," her destination was inevitable. She let herself through the side door of the garage and got her Raleigh. Her Raleigh Tough Burner had been her birthday gift in May and was also, quite simply, her favorite birthday gift of all time, then and forever. Even at 30, if her own son asked her the nicest thing she had ever been given, she would think immediately of the day-glow blue Raleigh Tough Burner with banana-yellow rims and fat tires. It was her favorite thing she owned, better than her Magic 8-Ball, her Kiss Color Form set, even her ColecoVision. She had spotted it in the window of Pro Wheels downtown 3 weeks before her birthday, when she was out with her father, and gave a big ooh at the sight. Her father, amused, walked her inside and talked the dealer into letting her ride it around the showroom. The salesman had strongly encouraged her to look at other bikes, felt that the Tough Burner was too big for her, even with the seat dropped to its lowest position. She didn't know what the guy was talking about. It was like witchcraft. She could have been riding a broom, slicing effortlessly through Halloween darkness, 1,000 feet off the ground. Her father had pretended to agree with the shopkeeper, though, and told Vic she could have something like it when she was older. 3 weeks later, it was in the driveway, with a big silver bow stuck on the handlebars. "You're older now, ain't you?" her father said, and winked. She slipped into the garage, where the Tough Burner leaned against the wall to the left of her father's bike. Not a bicycle, but a black 1979 Harley-Davidson shovelhead, what he still rode to work in the summer. Her father was a blaster, had a job on a road crew shearing apart ledge with high explosives, and foe mostly, sometimes straight TNT. He had told Vic once that it took a clever man to figure out a way to make a profit off his bad habits. When she asked him what he meant, he said most guys who liked to set off bombs wound up in pieces or doing time. In his case, it earned him 60 grand a year and was good for even more if he ever managed to frag himself. He had a hell of an insurance package. His pinky alone was worth 20 thou if he blew it off. His motorcycle had an airbrushed painting of a comically sexy blonde in an American flag bikini straddling a bomb against a backdrop of flame. Vic's father was badass. Other dads built things.
Hurt blew shit up and rode away on a Harley, smoking the cigarette he used to light the fuse. Top that. The brat had permission to ride her Raleigh on the trails in the Pittman Street Woods, the unofficial name of the 30-acre strip of scrub pine and birch that lay just beyond their backyard. She was allowed to go as far as the Merrimack River and the covered bridge before she had to turn back. The woods continued on the other side of that covered bridge, also known as the Shorter Way Bridge, but Vic had been forbidden to cross it. The Shorter Way was 70 years old, 300 feet long, and beginning to sag in the middle. Its walls sloped downriver, and it looked like it would collapse in a strong wind. A chain-link fence barred entrance, although kids had peeled the steel wire up at one corner and gone in there to smoke bud and make out. The tin sign on the fence said, "Declared unsafe by order of Haverhill PD." It was a place for delinquents, derelicts, and the deranged. She had been in there, of course. No comment on which category she belonged to. Never mind her father's threats or the unsafe sign. She had dared herself to slip under the fence and walk 10 steps, and the brat had never been able to back down on a dare, even one she made to herself, especially on the dares she made to herself. It was 5 degrees cooler in there, and there were gaps between the floorboards that looked down 100 feet toward the wind-roughened water. Holes in the black tar-paper roof let in dust-filled shafts of golden light. Bats peeped shrilly in the dark. It had made Vic's breath quicken to walk out into the long, shadowed tunnel that bridged not just a river, but death itself. She was 8, and she believed she was faster than anything, even a bridge collapse. But she believed it a little less when she was actually taking baby steps across the old, worn, creaky planks. She had made not just 10 steps, but 20. At the first loud pop, though, she rabbited, scrambled back and out under the chain-link fence, feeling as if she were half-choking on her own heart. Now she pointed her bike across the backyard, and in another moment was rattling downhill over root and rock into the forest. She plunged away from her house and straight into one of her patented make-believe Knight Rider stories. She was in the Knight 2000, and they were riding, soaring effortlessly along beneath the trees as the summer day deepened into lemony twilight. They were on a mission to retrieve a microchip containing the secret location of every single one of America's missile silos. It was hidden in her mother's bracelet. The chip was a part of the gemstone butterfly, cleverly disguised as a diamond. Mercenaries had it and planned to auction the information to the highest bidder. Iran, the Russians, maybe Canada. Vic and Michael Knight were approaching their hideout by a back road. Michael wanted Vic to promise him she wouldn't take unnecessary chances, wouldn't be a stupid kid, and she scoffed at him and rolled her eyes, but they both understood, owing to the exigencies of the plot, that at some point she would have to act like a stupid kid, endangering both of their lives and forcing them to take desperate maneuvers to escape the bad guys. Only this narrative wasn't entirely satisfying. For starters, she clearly wasn't in a car. She was on a bike, thumping over roots, pedaling fast, fast enough to keep off the mosquitoes. Also, she couldn't relax and let herself daydream the way she usually could. She kept thinking, "Jesus, what an ugly fucking person you are inside." She had a sudden stomach-twisting thought that when she got home, her father would be gone. The brat lowered her head and pedaled faster, the only way to leave such a terrible idea behind. She was on the bike, was her next thought. Not the tough burner, but her father's Harley. Her arms were around him, and she was wearing the helmet he had bought for her, the black full-head helmet that made her feel like she was half-dressed in a spacesuit. They were heading back to Lake Winnipesaukee to get her mother's bracelet. They were going to surprise her with it. Her mother would shout when she saw it in her father's hand, and her father would laugh and hook an arm around Linda McQueen's waist and kiss her cheek, and they wouldn't be mad at each other anymore. The brat glided through flickering sunlight beneath the overhanging boughs. She was close enough to 495 to hear it, the grinding roar of an 18-wheeler downshifting, the hum of the cars, and yes, even the rumbling blast of a motorcycle making its way south. When she shut her eyes, she was on the highway herself, making good time, enjoying the feeling of weightlessness as the bike tilted into the curves. She did not note that in her mind she was alone on the bike now, a bigger girl, old enough to twist the throttle herself. She'd shut the both of them up. She'd get the bracelet and come back and throw it on the bed between her parents and walk out without a word, leave them staring at each other in embarrassment. But mostly she was imagining the bike, the headlong rush into the miles as the last of the day's light fled the sky. She slipped from fur-scented gloom and out onto the wide dirt road that ran up to the bridge. The shorter way, locals called it, all one word. As she approached the bridge, she saw that the chain-link fence was down. The wire mesh had been wrenched off the posts and was lying in the dirt. The entrance, just barely wide enough to admit a single car, was framed in tangles of ivy, waving gently in the rush of air coming up from the river below. Within was a rectangular tunnel, extending to a square of unbelievable brightness, as if the far end opened onto a valley of golden wheat, or maybe just gold. She slowed for a moment. She was in a cycling trance, had ridden deep into her own head, and when she decided to keep going, right over the fence and into the darkness, she did not question the choice overmuch. To stop now would be a failure of courage she could not permit. Besides, she had faith in speed. If boards began to snap beneath her, she would just keep going, getting off the rotten wood before it could give way. If there was someone in there, some derelict who wanted to put his hands on a little girl, she would be past him before he could move. The thought of old wood shattering, or a bum grabbing for her, filled her chest with lovely terror, and instead of giving her pause, caused her to stand up and work the pedals even harder. She thought, too, with a certain calm satisfaction, that if the bridge did crash into the river, 10 stories below, and she was smashed in the rubble, it would be her parents' fault for fighting and driving her out of the house, and that would teach them. They would miss her terribly, would be sick with grief and guilt, and it was exactly what they had coming, the both of them. The chain links rattled and banged beneath her tires. She plunged into a subterranean darkness that reeked of bats and rot. As she entered, she saw something written on the wall to her left in green spray paint. She did not slow to read it, but thought it said Terry's, which was funny, because they had eaten at a place called Terry's for lunch, Terry's Primo Subs in Hampton, which was back in New Hampshire, on the sea. It was their usual place to stop on their way home from Lake Winnipesaukee, located about halfway between Haverhill and the lake. Sound was different inside the covered bridge. She heard the river, 100 feet below, but it sounded less like rushing water, more like a blast of white noise, of static on the radio. She did not look down, was afraid to see the river between the occasional gaps in the boards beneath. She did not even look from side to side, but kept her gaze fixed on the far end of the bridge. She passed through stammering rays of white light. When she crossed through one of those wafer-thin sheets of brightness, she felt it in her left eye, a kind of distant throb. The floor had an unpleasant sense of give. She had just a single thought now, 2 words long. Almost there. Almost there. Keeping time with the churning of her feet. The square of brightness at the far end of the bridge expanded and intensified. As she approached, she was conscious of an almost brutal heat emanating from the exit. She inexplicably smelled suntan lotion and onion rings. It did not cross her mind to wonder why there was no gate here, at the other end of the bridge, either. Vic McQueen, a.k.a. the Brat, drew a deep gulp of air and rode out of the shorter way into the sunlight, tires thumpity-thumping off the wood and onto blacktop. The hiss and roar of white noise ended abruptly, as if she really had been listening to static on the radio, and someone had just poked the power switch. She glided another 12 feet before she saw where she was. Her heart grabbed in her chest before her hands could grab for the brakes. She came to a stop so hard, with such force, that the back tire whipped around, skidding across asphalt, flinging dirt. She had emerged behind a 1-story building in a paved alley. A dumpster and a collection of trash cans stood against the brick wall to her left. One end of the alley was closed off by a high plank fence. There was a road on the other side of that fence. Vic could hear traffic rolling by, heard a snatch of a song trailing from one of the cars. Abra, abra, cadabra. I want to reach out and grab ya. Vic knew on first glance that she was in the wrong place. She had been down to the shorter way many times, looked across the high banks of the Merrimack to the other side often enough to know what lay over there, a timbered hill, green and cool and quiet. No road, no shop, no alley. She turned her head and very nearly screamed. The shorter way bridge filled the mouth of the alley behind her. It was rammed right into it, between the one-story building of brick and a five-story high building of whitewashed concrete and glass. The bridge no longer crossed a river, but was stuffed into a space that could barely contain it. Vic shivered violently at the sight of it. When she looked into the darkness, she could distantly see the emerald-tinted shadows of the Pittman Street woods on the other end. Vic climbed off her bike. Her legs shook in nervous bursts. She walked her Raleigh over to the dumpster and leaned it against the side. She found she lacked the courage to think too directly about the shorter way. The alley stank of fried food going bad in the sun. She wanted fresh air. She walked past a screen door looking into a noisy, steamy kitchen and to the high wooden fence. She unlatched the door in the side and let herself out onto a narrow strip of sidewalk that she knew well. She had stood on it only hours ago. When she looked to the left, she saw a long stretch of beach and the ocean beyond, the green cresting waves glistening with a painful brightness in the sun. Boys in swim trunks tossed a frisbee, leaping to make show-off catches and then falling in the dunes. Cars rolled along the oceanfront boulevard, bumper to bumper. She walked around the corner on unsteady legs and looked at the walk-up window of Terry's Primo Subs, Hampton Beach, New Hampshire. Vic walked past a row of motorcycles leaning out front, chrome burning in the afternoon sun. There was a line of girls at the order window, girls in bikini tops and short shorts, laughing bright laughter. How Vic hated the sound of them, which was like hearing glass shatter. She went in. A brass bell dinged on the door. The windows were open, and half a dozen desktop fans were running behind the counter, blowing air out toward the tables, and still it was too hot inside. Long spools of flypaper hung from the ceiling and wavered in the breeze. The brat didn't like looking at that flypaper, at the insects that had been caught on it, to struggle and die while people shoved hamburgers into their mouths directly below. She had not noticed the flypaper when she'd eaten lunch here earlier in the day with her parents. She felt woozy, as if she'd been running around on a full stomach in the August heat. A big man in a white undershirt stood behind the cash register. His shoulders were hairy and crimson with sunburn, and there was a line of zinc painted on his nose. A white plastic tag on his shirt said Pete. He had been here all afternoon. 2 hours before, Vic had stood next to her father while Chris McQueen paid him for their burger baskets and their milkshakes. The two men had talked about the Red Sox, who were on a good run. 1986 was looking like the year they might finally break the curse. Clemens was mowing them down. The kid had the Cy Young locked up with more than a month left to play. Vic turned toward him, if not for any reason, then because she recognized him. But then she just stood there in front of him, blinking, no idea what to say. A fan hummed at Pete's back and caught the humid, human smell of him, wafted it into the brat's face. No, she was definitely not feeling too good. She was ready to cry, gripped with an unfamiliar sensation of helplessness. She was here in New Hampshire, where she didn't belong. The shorter way bridge was stuck in the alley out back, and somehow this was her fault. Her parents were fighting and had no idea how far away she had got from them. All this needed to be said and more. She needed to call home. She needed to call the police. Someone had to go look at the bridge in the alley. Her thoughts were a sickening turmoil. The inside of her head was a bad place, a dark tunnel full of distracting noise and whirling bats. But the big man saved her the trouble of figuring out where to start. His eyebrows knitted together at the sight of her.
"There you are. I was wondering if I was going to see you again. You came back for it, huh?"
Vic stared at him blankly. "Came back?"
"For the bracelet. One with the butterfly on it."
He poked a key, and the register drawer popped open with a clashing chime. Her mother's bracelet was in the back. When Vic saw it, another weak tremor passed through her legs and she let out an unsteady sigh. For the first time since exiting the shorter way and finding herself impossibly in Hampton Beach, she felt something like understanding. She had gone looking for her mother's bracelet in her imagination, and somehow she had found it. She had never gone out on her bike, at all. Probably her parents had never really fought. There was only one way to explain a bridge crammed into an alley. She had gotten home, sunburned and exhausted, with a belly full of milkshake, had passed out on her bed, and now was dreaming. With that in mind, she supposed the best thing she could do was get her mother's bracelet and go back across the bridge, at which point she would presumably wake up. There was another dull throb of pain behind her left eye. A headache was rooting itself there. A bad one. She couldn't remember ever carrying a headache into a dream before. "Thank you," said the brat as Pete handed the bracelet across the counter to her. "My mom was really worried about it. It's worth a lot."
"Really worried, huh?"
Pete stuck a pinky in one ear and twisted it back and forth.
"Got a lot of sentimental value, I guess."
"No, I mean, yes, it does. It belonged to her grandmother, my great-grandmother. But, I mean, it's also very valuable."
"Uh-huh," he said.
"It's an antique," said the brat, not entirely sure why she felt the need to persuade him of its value.
"It's only an antique if it's worth something. If it's not worth anything, it's just an old thingamajig."
"It's diamonds," the brat said. "Diamonds and gold." Pete laughed. A short, caustic bark of laughter.
"It is," she said. Pete said, "Nah, costume jewelry. Those things look like diamonds? Zirconia. And see inside the band where it's going silver? Gold don't come off. What's good stays good no matter how much of a beating it takes."
His brow wrinkled in an expression of unexpected sympathy.
"You okay? You don't look so hot."
"I'm all right," she said. "I've had a lot of sun," which seemed a very grown-up thing to say. She wasn't all right, though. She felt dizzy, and her legs were trembling steadily. She wanted to be outside, away from the mingled perfume of peat sweat and onion rings and bubbling deep fat. She wanted this dream over with.
"Are you sure I can't get you something cold to drink?" Pete asked.
"Thanks, but I had a milkshake when I was in for lunch."
"If you had a milkshake, you didn't get it here," Pete said. "McDonald's, maybe. What we got is frappes."
"I have to go," she said, turning and starting back toward the door. She was aware of sunburned Pete watching her with real concern and was grateful to him for his empathy. She thought that in spite of his stink and brusque manner, he was a good man, the kind of man who would worry about a sick-looking little girl out on her own along Hampton Beach. But she didn't dare say anything else to him. The ill sweat was damp on her temples and upper lip, and it took a great deal of concentration to clamp down on the tremors in her legs. Her left eye thudded again, a bit less gently this time. Her conviction that she was only imagining this visit to Terry's, that she was tramping through a particularly forceful dream, was hard to hold on to, like trying to keep a grip on a slick frog. Vic stepped back outside and walked swiftly along the hot concrete, past the parked and leaning motorcycles. She opened the door in the tall plank fence and stepped into the alley behind Terry's Primo Subs. The bridge hadn't moved. Its exterior walls were crammed right up against the buildings on either side. It hurt to look at it dead on. It hurt in her left eye. A cook or a dishwasher, someone who worked in the kitchen, stood in the alley by the dumpster. He wore an apron streaked with grease and blood. Anyone who had a good look at that apron would probably skip getting lunch at Terry's. He was a little man with a bristly face and veined, tattooed forearms, and he stared at the bridge with an expression located somewhere between outrage and fright.
"What the motherfuck?" the guy said. He cast a confused look at Vic. "Do you see that, kid? I mean, what the motherfuck is that?"
"My bridge. Don't worry. I'll take it with me," Vic said. She was herself unclear what she meant by this.
She gripped her bike by the handlebars, turned it around, and pushed it toward the bridge. She ran alongside it two steps and then threw her leg over. The front tire bumped up onto the boards, and she plunged into hissing darkness. The sound, that idiot roar of static, rose as the Raleigh carried her out across the bridge. On the way across, she had believed she was hearing the river below, but that wasn't it. There were long cracks in the walls, and for the first time she looked at them as they flashed by. Through them she saw a flickering white brilliance, as if the world's largest TV set were just on the other side of the wall, and it was stuck on a channel that wasn't broadcasting. A storm blew against the lopsided and decrepit bridge, a blizzard of light. She could feel the bridge buckling just slightly as the downpour dashed itself against the walls. She shut her eyes, didn't want to see anymore, stood up on the pedals and rode for the other side. She tried her prayer-like chant once more, almost there, almost there, but was too winded and sick to maintain any one thought for long. There was only her breath and the roaring, raging static, that endless waterfall of sound, rising in volume, building to a maddening intensity, and then building some more until she wanted to cry out for it to stop. The word coming to her lips, stop, stop it, her lungs gathering air to shout, and that was when the bike thudded back down in Haverhill, Massachusetts. The sound cut out with a soft electrical pop. She felt that pop in her head, in her left temple, a small but sharply felt explosion. She knew even before she opened her eyes that she was home, or not home, but in her woods at least. She knew they were her woods by the smell of pines and the quality of the air, a scrubbed, cool, clean sensation that she associated with the Merrimack River. She could hear the river, distantly, a gentle, soothing rush of sound that was really in no way like static. She opened her eyes, lifted her head, shook her hair out of her face. The late-day sunlight blinked through the leaves above her in irregular flashes. She slowed, squeezed the brakes, and put one foot down. Vic turned her head for a last look back across the bridge at Hampton Beach. She wondered if she could still see the fry cook in his dirty apron. Only she couldn't see him, because the shorter way bridge was gone. There was a guardrail where the entrance to the bridge belonged. Beyond that, the ground fell away in a steep and weedy slope that ended at the deep blue channel of the river. Three chipped concrete pylons, bracket-shaped at the top, poked out of the tossing, agitated water. That was all that was left of the shorter way. Vic didn't understand. She had just ridden across the bridge, had smelled the old, rotting, sun-baked wood and the rank hint of bat piss, had heard the boards knocking under her tires. Her left eye throbbed. She shut it and rubbed it hard with her palm and opened it again. And for a moment she thought the bridge was there. She saw, or thought she saw, a kind of after-image of it, a white glare in the shape of a bridge, reaching all the way to the opposite bank. But the after-image didn't last, and her left eye was streaming tears, and she was too weary to wonder for long what had happened to the bridge. She had never, in all her life, so needed to be home, in her room, in her bed, in the crisp folds of her sheets. She got on her bike, but could only pedal a few yards before she gave up. She stepped off and pushed, her head down and her hair swinging. Her mother's bracelet rolled loosely on her sweaty wrist. She hardly noticed it there. Vic pushed the bike across the yellowing grass of the backyard, past the playset she never played on anymore, the chains of the swings caked in rust. She dropped her bike in the driveway and went inside. She wanted to get to her bedroom, wanted to lie down and rest. But when she heard a tinny crack in the kitchen, she veered off course to see who was in there. It was her father, who stood with his back to her, can of Stroh's in one hand. He was running the other hand under cold water in the sink, turning his knuckles beneath the faucet. Vic wasn't sure how long she had been gone. The clock on the toaster oven was no help. It blinked 12 o'clock over and over, as if it had just been reset. The lights were off, too, the room cool with afternoon shadow. "Dad," she said, in a weary voice she hardly recognized, "what time is it?
He glanced at the oven, then gave his head a little shake.
Damned if I know. The power blinked out about 5 minutes ago. I think the whole street is...
But then he glanced back at her, eyebrows rising in a question.
What's up? You all right?
He turned off the water and grabbed a rag to pat his hand dry.
You don't look so hot.
She laughed, a strained, humorless sound.
That's what Pete said.
Her own voice seemed to come from way far off, from the other end of a long tunnel.
Pete who?
Hampton Beach Pete.
Vic?
I'm all right. She tried to swallow and couldn't. She was painfully thirsty, although she hadn't known it until she saw her father standing there with a cold drink in his hand. She shut her eyes for a moment and saw a sweating glass of chilly pink grapefruit juice, an image that seemed to cause every cell in her body to ache with need.
I'm just thirsty. Do we have any juice?
Sorry, kid. Fridge is pretty empty. Mom hasn't been to the grocery store yet.
Is she lying down?
Don't know, he said. He did not add, don't care, but it was there in his tone.
Oh, Vic said, and she slipped the bracelet off her wrist and put it on the kitchen table. When she comes out, tell her I found her bracelet.
He slammed the door of the fridge and looked around. His gaze shifted to the bracelet, then back to her.
Where?
In the car, between the seats.
The room darkened, as if the sun had disappeared behind a great mass of clouds. Vic swayed. Her father put the back of his hand to her face, the hand that held his can of beer. He had abraded his knuckles on something.
Christ, you're burning up, Brad. Hey, Lynn!
I'm fine, Vic said. I'm just gonna lie down for a minute.
She didn't mean to lie down right there, right then. The plan was to walk back to her room and stretch out under her awesome new David Hasselhoff poster, but her legs gave way and she dropped. Her father caught her before she could hit the floor. He scooped her into the air, a hand under her legs, another under her back, and carried her into the hall.
Lynn! Chris McQueen called out again.
Linda emerged from her bedroom, holding a wet washcloth to the corner of her mouth. Her feathery auburn hair was disheveled, and her eyes unfocused, as if she had in fact been asleep. Her gaze sharpened when she saw the brat in her husband's arms. She met them at the door to Vic's bedroom. Linda reached up with slender fingers and pushed the hair back from Vic's brow, pressed a hand to her forehead. Linda's palm was chilly and smooth, and her touch set off a shivering fit that was one part sickness, one part pleasure. Vic's parents weren't mad at each other anymore, and if the brat had known that all she had to do to bring them together again was make herself sick, she could have skipped going across the bridge to get the bracelet and just stuck a finger down her throat.
What happened to her?
She passed out, Chris said.
No, I didn't, said the brat.
100-degree fever and falling down, and she wants to argue with me, said her father with unmistakable admiration.
Her mother lowered the washcloth she was holding to the corner of her own mouth.
Heat stroke. 3 hours in that car and then right outside on her bike, no sunscreen on, and nothing to drink all day except that rotten milkshake at Terry's.
Frappe. They call them frappes at Terry's, Vic said. You hurt your mouth.
Her mother licked the corner of her swollen lips.
I'll get a glass of water and some ibuprofen. We'll both take some.
While you're in the kitchen, why don't you grab your bracelet, Chris said. It's on the table.
Linda took 2 steps before registering what her husband had said. She looked back. Chris McQueen stood in the door to Vic's room, holding her in his arms. Vic could see David Hasselhoff over her bed, smiling at her, looking like he could barely suppress the urge to wink.
You did good, kid.
It was in the car, Chris said. The brat found it.
Home. Vic slept. Her dreams were an incoherent flicker show of still images. A gas mask on a cement floor. A dead dog by the side of the road with its head smashed in. A forest of towering pine trees hung with blind white angels. This last image was so vivid and mysteriously awful. those dark 60-foot-high trees swaying in the wind like stoned revelers in a pagan ceremony, the angels flashing and gleaming in their branches, that she wanted to scream. She tried to yell but couldn't force any sound up her throat. She was trapped beneath a suffocating avalanche of shadow stuff, a mountainous heap of soft, airless matter. She fought to claw her way out, shoving desperately, flailing about with all the angry, wiry strength she could muster, until suddenly she found herself sitting up in bed, her whole body greased in sweat. Her father sat on the edge of the mattress beside her, holding her by the wrists. "Vic," he said. "Vic, relax. You just smacked me hard enough to turn my head around. Lay off. It's Dad."
"Oh," she said.
He let go of her, and her arms dropped to her sides.
"Sorry."
He held his jaw between thumb and forefinger and wiggled it back and forth.
"It's okay. Probably had it coming."
"For what?"
"I don't know. For whatever. Everyone's got summon."
She leaned forward and kissed his whiskery chin, and he smiled.
"Your fever broke," her father said. "You feel better?"
She shrugged. Suppose she felt all right, now that she was out from under the great pile of black blankets and away from that dream forest of malevolent Christmas trees.
"You were pretty out of it," he said. "You should have heard yourself."
"What did I say?"
"At one point you were shouting that the bats were out of the bridge," he told her. "I think you meant belfry."
"Yeah, I mean, no, I was probably talking about the bridge." Vic had forgotten for a moment about the shorter way.
"What happened to the bridge, Dad?"
"Bridge?"
"The shorter way. The old covered bridge. It's all gone."
"Oh," he said. "I heard that some dumb son of a bitch tried to drive his car across it and went right through. Got himself killed and brought down most of the bridge with him. They demoed the rest. That's why I told you I didn't want you going out on that damn thing. They should have taken it down 20 years ago.
She shivered.
"Look at you," her father said. "You are just sick as a dog."
She thought of her fever dream about the dog with the smashed-in head, and the world first brightened, then dimmed. When her vision cleared, her father was holding a rubber bucket against her chest.
"If you have to choke something up," he said, "try and get it in the pail. Christ, I'll never take you to friggin' Terry's again."
She remembered the smell of peat sweat and the ribbons of flypaper coated with dead bugs, and vomited. Her father walked out with the pail of sick. He came back with a glass of ice water. She drank half in 3 swallows. It was so cold it set off a fresh shivering fit. Chris pulled the blankets up around her again, put his hand on her shoulder, and sat with her, waiting for the chill to pass. He didn't move. He didn't talk. It was calming just to have him there, to share in his easy, self-assured silence, and in almost no time at all, she felt herself sliding down into sleep. Sliding down into sleep, or writing, maybe. With her eyes closed, she had a sensation, almost, of being on her bike again and gliding effortlessly into dark and restful quiet. When her father rose to go, though, she was still conscious enough to be aware of it, and she made a noise of protest and reached for him. He slipped away.
"Get your rest, Vic," he whispered. "We'll have you back on your bike in no time."
She drifted. His voice came to her from far off.
"I'm sorry they took the shorter way down," he murmured.
"I thought you didn't like it," she said,
rolling over and away from him, letting him go, giving him up.
"I thought you were scared I'd try to ride my bike on it."
"That's right," he said. "I was scared. I mean, I'm sorry they went and took it down without me. If they were going to blow the thing out of the sky, wish they'd let me set the charges. That bridge was always a death trap. Anyone could see it was going to kill someone someday. I'm just glad it didn't kill you. Go to sleep, short stuff."
Various locales. In a few months, the incident of the lost bracelet was largely forgotten, and when Vic did remember it, she remembered finding the thing in the car. She did not think about the shorter way if she could help it. The memory of her trip across the bridge was fragmented and had a quality of hallucination about it,
was inseparable from the dream she'd had of dark trees and dead dogs. It did her no good to recollect it, and so she tucked the memory away in a safe deposit box of the mind, locked it out of sight, and forgot about it. And she did the same with all the other times, because there were other times, other trips on her Raleigh across a bridge that wasn't there, to find something that had been lost. There was the time her friend Willa Lords lost Mr. Pentack, her good-luck corduroy penguin. Willa's parents cleaned out her room one day while Willa was sleeping over at Vic's house, and Willa believed that Mr. Pentack had been chucked into the garbage along with her Tinkerbell mobile and the light bright board that didn't work anymore. Willa was inconsolable, so torn up she couldn't go to school the next day, or the day after. But Vic made it better. It turned out that Willa had brought Mr. Pentack along for the sleepover. Vic found it under her bed, among the dust bunnies and forgotten socks. Tragedy averted. Vic certainly didn't believe she found Mr. Pentack by climbing on her Raleigh and riding through the Pitman Street woods to the place where the shorter way bridge had once stood. She did not believe the bridge was waiting there, or that she had seen writing on the wall in green spray paint, Fenway Bowling. She did not believe the bridge had been filled with a roar of static and that mystery lights flashed and raced beyond its pine walls. She had an image in her mind of riding out of the shorter way and into a darkened bowling alley, empty at 7 in the morning. The covered bridge was, absurdly, sticking right through the wall and opened into the lanes themselves. Vic knew the place. She had gone to a birthday party there 2 weeks before. Willa had been there, too. The pine flooring was shiny, greased with something, and Vic's bike squirted across it like butter in a hot pan. She went down and banged her elbow. Mr. Pentack was in a lost-and-found basket behind the counter, under the shelves of bowling shoes. This was all just a story she told herself the night after she discovered Mr. Pentack under her bed. She was sick that night, hot and clammy, with the dry heaves, and her dreams were vivid and unnatural. The scrape on her elbow healed in a couple days. When she was 10, she found her father's wallet between the cushions in the couch, not on a construction site in Attleboro. Her left eye throbbed for days after she found the wallet, as if someone had punched her. When she was 11, the DeZotes, who lived across the street, lost their cat. The cat, Taylor, was a scrawny old thing, white with black patches. He had gone out just before a summer cloudburst and not returned. Mrs. DeZote walked up and down the street the next morning, chirping like a bird, mewling Taylor's name. Mr. DeZote, a scarecrow of a man who wore bow ties and suspenders, stood in the yard with his rake, not raking anything, a kind of hopelessness in his pale eyes. Vic particularly liked Mr. DeZote, a man with a funny accent like Arnold Schwarzenegger's, who had a miniature battlefield in his office. Mr. DeZote smelled like fresh-brewed coffee and pipe smoke, and let Vic paint his little plastic infantrymen. Vic liked Taylor the cat, too. When he purred, he made a rusty clackety-clack in his chest, like a machine with old gears, trundling to noisy life. No one ever saw Taylor again. Although Vic told herself a story about riding across the shorter way bridge and finding the poor old thing matted with blood and swarming with flies in the wet weeds by the side of the highway. It had dragged itself out of the street after a car ran over its back. The brat could still see the bloodstains on the blacktop. Vic began to hate the sound of static. Spicy Menace, 1990. Sugar Creek, Pennsylvania. The ad was on one of the last pages of Spicy Menace, the August 1949 issue, the cover of which depicted a screaming nude frozen in a block of ice. She gave him the cold shoulder, so he gave her the big chill. It was just a single column, below a much larger advertisement for Adola Brasiers. Emphasize your figure. Bing Partridge noticed it only after a long, considering look at the lady in the Adola ad. A woman with pale, creamy mommy tits, supported by a bra with cone-shaped cups and a metallic sheen. Her eyes were closed, and her lips were parted slightly, so she looked like she was asleep and dreaming sweet dreams, and Bing had been imagining waking her with a kiss. "Bing and Adola sitting in a tree," Bing crooned.
F-U-C-K-I-N-G.
Bing was in his quiet place in the basement, with his pants down and his ass on the dusty concrete. His free hand was more or less where you would imagine it, but he was not particularly busy yet. He had been grazing his way through the issue, looking for the best parts, when he found it. A small block of print in the lower left corner of the page. A snowman in a top hat gestured with one crooked arm